Okay, now we want to get on to chapter 16 on media bias. Oh, do you think there is any such thing as media bias? Or is the media, the press, is it just fair and impartial and just the facts, nothing but the facts? Well, I think there is media bias, and I want to talk about it, but a couple of preliminary comments. First, people sometimes wonder, I sometimes wonder, what is wrong with our nation? Why does our country so often move in a direction that seems contrary to Christian values? And, of course, the most recent example is this controversy about same-sex marriage. And why is it that more and more people are approving that if it's contrary to the kind of deeply held values that many Americans have held for generations? What's happening to the country? Why is it moving in that direction? Which it seems to be anyway from polling. And then there are a number of other things. If the things that we believe are important to American values and traditions and history, if they're true and the facts show that they're helpful for the country, then why don't people more frequently approve these viewpoints when they vote? Why is it that large numbers of Americans anyway just don't seem to appreciate or be convinced about the value of what at least we see as biblically based values and things that are helpful and good for the country, helping the economy grow, protecting the country, keeping it safe, etc.? Why is it that the country doesn't just kind of, by large majorities, endorse these viewpoints? What is going on? Well, I think that one big factor in influencing the course of the nation is what's collectively called the media. That would be the press, the newspapers, the television, but in a larger sense also movies and other kinds of forms of communication that are a powerful force in the country and really do tend to impact public opinion. And I want to give 7 or 8 examples of different topics where that's true this morning. Give a little other background to that first before I get on to talking about specific examples of media bias. I want to talk about what the Bible says about speaking truthfully about other people. And this especially applies to speaking truthfully about people who have public reputations. The biblical command, the fundamental command, is in the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, verse 16, "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor." And then in more detail in Exodus 23:1, "You shall not spread a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness." Leviticus 19:16, "You shall not go around as a slanderer among your people," tearing down people's reputations. And there are a number of New Testament verses also that talk about the sin of slander. Matthew 15:19, "Out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, and slander." And you probably have heard, and I have heard as well, of many people who say there's such a high price for going into politics because the press is relentlessly attacking people's reputations when they go into politics. But my argument this morning is going to be there is a selective attacking on people who hold more conservative viewpoints rather than people who hold more liberal viewpoints. And I want to illustrate that with a number of cases. It's not 100%. It's not 100% because there is some still reporting on misdeeds and wrong actions of people who have more liberal viewpoint. But often it seems to me these commands against bearing false witness and against slandering people, kind of repeating groundless accusations, that those commands are ignored by the behavior of the dominant press, the dominant media. What does the American public think about media and media bias. That's point A on your outline. Anybody need an outline? Hold up your hand. There should be one in your chair. Okay. Yeah. The majority of the U.S. public believes that the mass media has a liberal bias. For instance, 70% of the population, whether they voted for Barack Obama or not, 70% of the population believe that the media wanted President Obama to win the election. That's a lot larger than the number of people who voted for him, which is 50-some percent, but 70% thought the media wanted him to win. And what would that be, the mainstream media? Well, what I mean by that is television networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, and MSNBC for television. And I suppose you are aware that Fox News has a more conservative direction in its reporting, and Fox News gets more viewers than any one of those that I just mentioned, ABC, CBS, NBC, MSNBC, CNN. But when you put all those others together, of course, they're bigger than Fox News in their impact by far. And then newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, and the USA Today, those five most influential papers. And then many other newspapers pick up the same articles. And so the New York Times just actually fell in circulation. It's been dropping, and it's finally fallen below a million copies in circulation each day. It's at 928,000. The Wall Street Journal, which is more conservative, over twice that circulation, 2 million, over 2 million. The New York Times under 1 million. But the influence of the New York Times is way out of proportion to its numbers, because the sort of opinion makers in society very often read the New York Times and adopt its viewpoints. In addition to that, when an article is published in the New York Times, then many, many other local newspapers and other media outlets will pick up that article and repeat it. So if you kind of read before the first line in a news article, oftentimes it'll say, by so-and-so New York Times, even though it happens to be in the Arizona Republic or some other local paper. And so there's still a very strong impact of those newspapers. The Wall Street Journal stands separate from these other newspapers because its editorial pages follow a philosophy: free markets, free people. Just four words: free markets, free people. And since the 1800s, the Wall Street Journal has been following that philosophy. And so I read the Wall Street Journal editorial pages every day. And when Margaret and I were going out to Philadelphia last week, we were away from home. I'm in the airport. I go to the newsstand. I plop down my $2 and get the Wall Street Journal and read the editorial pages, because they have a more conservative viewpoint. They don't have a specifically Christian viewpoint, but they are promoting free markets and free people. Free people means smaller government, less regulation on people's lives. So, the Wall Street Journal is the largest circulation newspaper in the United States now, which I find encouraging. It just recently surpassed USA Today. USA Today has just under 2 million subscribers or in print each day, and the Wall Street Journal just over 2 million. So with all of that, number four, only 29% of Americans, feel that the mainstream media gets its facts straight. That's not a very good reputation for reliability. And 63% of Americans feel that news stories are often inaccurate. And, you know, part of that perception is fueled by the fact that ordinary Americans are in the news every once in a while. And when you are reported on in the news, and then you see something and say, that's not what I said, or that's taken out of context, but oftentimes you have no recourse because they control what goes into print. and that builds up over time. So under number 6 on your outline, over a 17-year period from 1988 to 2005, there was a decline in the number of people thinking that news organizations are highly professional. Declined from 72 to 49%. Point C, a belief that news organizations cover up errors. Look at this. It used to be 13% thought they covered up errors. Now 67% of the population thinks they cover up errors. And the number that think they're politically biased is has risen to 59%. At point eight, I mentioned this, that I am concerned about the liberal bias in the media in this country. However, we still have a free country and a free press, and it is a wonderful situation compared to totalitarian governments. I think back a couple years ago when we were in China, and I'd get an email and someone would say to me, "Oh, Wayne, look at this video on YouTube." And I'd click on YouTube and the screen would go white because he couldn't get through to YouTube. And if there was any news article in a major news event that was critical of China, when I was in China, I couldn't get on the internet. I couldn't get internet access to the article. So, I mean, there is massive internet censorship and other kinds of press censorship in totalitarian governments. China, North Korea, of course, is horrible, and many other dictatorships in the world, in terms of Muslim dictatorships, for instance, would be much less free than we are. So I'm not saying the situation is horrible, but I'm saying it's still of significant concern. And one thing that is balancing against the mainstream media, mainstream liberal media bias is there are alternative sources of news. For instance, in newspaper, the most influential newspaper is the New York Times. Second most influential is the Washington Post. But about 30 years ago, 20 or 30 years ago, a conservative alternative newspaper was started in Washington called the Washington Times. And it doesn't have as much circulation, but it discovers good stories and gets quoted from time to time. National Review, Weekly Standard, First Things. Stephen, I think I've got a little echo here, a feedback. Maybe we can turn it down a little bit. How's that? All right? Am I okay? All right. Better? Those are some conservative journals that report news. National Review, Weekly Standard, First Things, Town Hall Magazine, World Magazine. How many of you are getting that subscription to World Magazine now? Yeah, good. Do you like it? Okay. And Fox News and conservative talk radio outlets. So there's some balancing factors. Now, what about surveys of journalists? Point B on your outline. I'm going to go over this very quickly, but the coverage of Barack Obama as a candidate, 65% positive articles versus 31% positive articles for John McCain, and imbalances, the statistics are 12-1 voting for Democratic candidates as opposed to Republican candidates, or 15-1, or here's this one survey of a media outlet, 55-1 voting for Obama versus McCain. So that's a very disproportionate number of people who have at least personal donations or votes for a Democratic candidate as opposed to a Republican candidate. Now you could say, well, maybe they're still going to be fair in their reporting, and I know many reporters seek to be fair and think of themselves as fair, but when there is that disproportion of political convictions, it's going to end up influencing the outcome of what they write in print and put on the news commentaries on TV. Point B, a survey of MSNBC, 125 journalists gave to Democratic candidates, 16 gave to Republicans. That's a disproportion. Or the Seattle Times, talking about the journalism profession generally, most of the people who go into this business and become journalists tend to vote Democratic, at least in national elections. I'll just read one other quotation. New York Times public editor, who was supposed to address questions of bias in the reporting, he said, these are the social issues, gay rights, gun control, abortion, environmental regulation, among others. If you think the Times plays it down the middle on any of them, you've been reading the paper with your eyes closed. So he's just saying, no, we do have a viewpoint that we're promoting. And I think underneath that is probably often a sincere, well-intentioned desire to bring about change in the nation on the part of journalists. But the change they are seeking to bring about is change in a more liberal political direction, particularly equalizing incomes. And when you seek to equalize incomes, thinking that's a more just outcome, then you become largely anti-business and you adopt policies that oppose economic growth. And there's also, as I said, some other convictions, like conviction that use of military force is most often wrong and conflicts should be resolved by other means, conviction that a world government and world courts would be better at resolving disputes than just national sovereignty, and a number of other issues like that. And certainly on the abortion issue, on the homosexual rights issue, those are biases that come out. And so now I want to give you under number B2, that's the first example of bias selection of material. I'm going to go through about 8 different issues and say, here are some examples of how this works out in actual practice. What do you think? The economic crisis, my book talked about the 2008 to 2009 economic crisis. I could now say the 2008 to 2011 economic crisis, because we're still not out of the woods in terms of the economy and its health. But what did the press blame this on? Market failure? That's criticizing free markets. Deregulation? That's criticizing free markets, because they're saying, we need a government to control this. And the government, when it backed off and didn't control things as much, it was deregulating. And of course, those evil businesses, when they're allowed to just act without government control, then they do bad things. And of course, that's why you're suffering. That's why you have unemployment, et cetera, in the economy. But in fact, my own understanding is that the causes of the economic crisis that began in 2009 and the recession, the causes were not market failure and were not deregulation, as so often mentioned in the media. My understanding in all the reading that I've done of that economic recession is that there were primarily 3 causes. Number one, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And look, long before 2008, for years, I was reading in the Wall Street Journal, almost every month it seems, they had these columns warning. There are these big, big organizations called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they guarantee that people will pay their mortgages. And if people don't pay their mortgages or default, well, they say, well, we'll back them up and we'll pay for them. And, this is kind of strange. And the Wall Street Journal said, well, when we say this is a government problem, the answer is, these aren't government agencies. These are quasi-public, quasi-private organizations. And so the government really isn't responsible for all those debts that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these organizations, are guaranteeing. So if, now I can't pick out any example in the front row, because I'm going to pick out an example of someone who can't pay his mortgage, and I'm not going to pick on anybody and say that. But Alan's volunteering John, and John's going to volunteer Alan. Okay, great. So, I'll take myself as an example. Let's say that I am either out of work or I have just a minimum wage job and I can't, I go to a bank and the bank says, sorry, Wayne, we can't give you a loan for a home because you don't make enough money or you don't have a consistent record of employment. So we don't see that you will be able to pay back this loan. So we can't loan you $100,000 to buy a home. Sorry, you don't qualify. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac come along and say, you know what? We think Wayne's a nice guy. We'll guarantee that if you loan money to him, we guarantee that we'll pay back that mortgage even if he can't pay it. Now, if you're a banker and you say, I can't lose. I'll make him a loan. I'll earn a little money on that loan because he's paying some interest on it. And what's the downside? If you're in business, there's no downside because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these organizations, these kind of mysterious organizations that people didn't understand very much, they're saying to the banks, we'll guarantee it. You won't lose money. It's a deal. Well, Wall Street Journal kept saying, this looks like trouble for us. Over $1 trillion of mortgages guaranteed. And if Barry were here, he'd have the exact number, but it's a fantastic number. And the Wall Street Journal said, who's going to pay for this? When we keep asking these members of Congress, who's going to pay for this? Say, don't worry. Government, the government's not responsible. Besides, look at the housing market. It's going up, up, up. Nobody's ever going to lose. Everybody's winning. And in fact, Republicans in Congress tried to bring reform to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, saying, stop making all these loans. Stop guaranteeing all these loans. There's no money to pay for this. You're putting taxpayers on the hook for this. Oh, no, oh, no. And the Democrats stopped those attempts at reform because they had enough votes in Congress to stop those attempts. And the key culprit in this was Barney Frank, Massachusetts congressman who had control of the regulatory committee in Congress that was over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But did the press mention this? Very little. Point B, then there were government requirements on banks that banks make a certain percentage of their loans to people whose financial ability would not allow them to qualify for loans. And so what happened was it was something called the Community Reinvestment Act, signed by Jimmy Carter in 1977. There were anti-poverty activists who said, look, the banks are evil. They're not making enough housing loans to poor neighborhoods in our cities. And so people aren't able to buy houses. And the banks were saying, well, these people aren't making enough income to qualify for a loan. Never mind, said the Community Reinvestment Act. You still have to make a certain percentage of your loans to people who are in poverty. Why? Well, because this is good for the country. We want more people to own homes. Well, what if they can't repay their loans? You still have to make those loans to them. Or if you don't, you might not get your license to continue working as a bank. And more than that, if you don't give a certain percentage of your loans to basically unqualified borrowers, you will be subject to civil liability for actual or punitive damages in individual or class actions, as much as $10,000 fine in individual actions, and $500,000 or 1% of the creditor's net worth in class actions. So now you got the banks facing a carrot and a stick. The carrot is, make a loan. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will guarantee it. You can't lose. You're going to make money. The stick is, if you don't make these loans, we'll fine you. And you can face up to loss of 1% of your net assets or $500,000. So the bank says, we're going to go ahead. Now, is it fair to characterize the banker's reaction to that situation as greed? See, the media perception that they put out was the economic crisis was caused by greed. But in fact, making all these unqualified loans, carrot and stick, government pushing to that for years, I think was the primary cause of this. And Barney Frank was the primary culprit because he stymied any attempt at reform for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But did the media criticize him? No, he got off scot-free and smiling as he walked away from the mess. And then the third thing was, I think, and Barry Asmus thinks also, a major problem was the irresponsible policy of the Federal Reserve Board keeping interest rates so low that encouraged people to borrow beyond what would be financially responsible. And it led to more and more credit being given and housing prices going up and up and up and created a bubble, and eventually it popped. Now, my point on this is Those three causes, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the government requirements for lending to people who couldn't repay, and the irresponsible policy of the Federal Reserve Board, both under the Bush administration and more recently under the Obama administration, that those three factors really explain most of the economic crisis. How much of that did you hear in the media? Very little. It was market failure, deregulation, greedy bankers. And I really don't think that those things were true. Okay, that's number one. Number two, repeated and prolonged attention in the press to conservative wrongdoing, but minimizing or ignoring wrongdoing by liberals. And point A here is reporting that Republican rallies or Tea Party rallies have a lot of anger, but not reporting that there is anger at Democratic rallies, which there is, or liberal rallies. It's probably much more. I don't know if you've seen that, but that just is a theme that comes up in media reports again and again. Or point D, only recently did media give attention to Charles Rangel's tax evasion problems. For many years, Charles Rangel failed to report income from a rental property for a villa in the Dominican Republic. Now, why is that a problem that Charles Rangel was failing to report rental income from a property in the Dominican Republic? Well, Charles Rangel happened to be, for years, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and they set tax policy for the United States. So the guy that had the most power in setting tax policy for the United States for years was evading taxes. How much? Finally, there was some media attention. Finally, in March 2010, he resigned as Ways and Means Chairman, but it went on for a long time. Number four, reporting unfounded liberal claims without fact-checking. And I'm going to talk for a few minutes about, I think, a very unfortunate and sad incident regarding Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh, in 2009, was part of a group of investors that were seeking to buy the St. Louis Rams football team. And all of a sudden, CNN's reporter Rick Sanchez reported that Rush Limbaugh had once made statements supporting slavery and thinking slavery was a good thing, and that Rush Limbaugh had made statements praising James Earl Ray, who murdered Martin Luther King. And this was just reported as fact on CNN by Rick Sanchez. Well, after a few days went by, people are challenging this and saying, where's the evidence for this? Well, there was a book in 2006 that said that Rush Limbaugh had said this. The book was 101 People Who Are Really Screwing America. That was the title of the book. And he said, well, I got it from this book, but the book didn't give any source for the quote. And when reporters contacted the publisher of the book, the publisher didn't return calls to the reporters. And they could find reports that Limbaugh had said this as far back as 1993, but nobody cited a source. Eventually, Rick Sanchez, the CNN reporter, sports reporter, who had reported this as fact, typed a little statement on Twitter saying, I've known Rush in person. I like him. His rhetoric, however, is inexclusively divisive. He's right, though. We didn't confirm, quote, our bad. That's all he said. Oh, we made a mistake. And he put it on Twitter. And so no public apology by CNN, no very visible retraction, just a destruction of Rush Limbaugh's reputation and no accountability for doing it. There's more on this. Snopes.com that refutes urban legends said, although this is often cited as something that Limbaugh said on the radio, April 23rd, 1998, we haven't turned up any references to this quote from earlier than 2005. Basically, somebody just made it up, and it took on a life of its own. But why was there an eagerness in the media to report this as fact, in the St. Louis newspaper, on CNN, to report it as fact without checking the fact? That's the fundamental responsibility of journalists. But it just took on a life of its own because people thought, oh, wow, here's some dirt on Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh wrote on October 16th, 2009, in the Wall Street Journal, "I never said I supported slavery. I never praised James Earl Ray. How sick would that be? Just as sick as those who would use such outrageous slanders against me or anyone else who never even thought such things." And see, now what does the Bible say about this? You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not spread a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not go about as a slanderer among your people. It seems to me that in the damage done to Rush Limbaugh's reputation, these commands were being violated by very powerful forces who have huge audiences. Eventually, the investor who had invited Rush Limbaugh to join the investment group purchasing the St. Louis Rams dropped Rush Limbaugh from the group because of the controversy. But there were no transcripts of any statements, no tapes showing that he had made such statements. They were nowhere to be found because the tapes and transcripts did not exist. Limbaugh had never made those statements. The mainstream media just yawned and went on to other stories. I'm going to watch my time here. I'm still okay. All right, thanks, Jack. I have a little note here CBS News anchor Dan Rather falsely reporting that George Bush had preferential treatment and poor performance in his 72 to 73 Air National Guard service. Now, within a day or so, people who were looking at this supposed memo from George W. Bush's commander in the Air National Guard said, wait a minute, this type font wasn't even designed until years after 1973, and the spacing of the words, when you actually measure it, no typewriter available in 1972-73 could have spaced the words that way. This is default spacing on a modern computer. Even so, CBS stuck with its story for two more weeks until finally they backed down, they had an investigation, and they fired producer Mary Mapes. Dan Rather took early retirement, probably forced into early retirement. He sued CBS for mishandling it. That suit was dismissed September 29th, 2009. But the question is, again, why does CBS go on for 2 weeks running this story as fact and proving it when the evidence just was not there to prove it? You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Another fact that I think we don't see as much now, but when there's a conservative administration in office and there's a war going on, reporting on the war often will wildly exaggerate numbers of civilian casualties. When the press is opposed to the president and opposed to the war and report casualties claimed by the enemies without verifying them, and the context of civilian casualties are often ignored. Now, it's going to happen again in a day or two. But last year, when we were on this Phoenix Seminary trip and we were in Israel one day, the next day we were supposed to dock at Ashdod so we could go into Jerusalem. But the previous day, there was this flotilla of boats attempting to get into the Gaza Strip, and who knows, but the Israelis thought probably to deliver weapons to attack Israel from. And so the Israeli commandos boarded the ship and said, you can't come into Israel without being inspected. Now, no nation's going to allow ships to come without being inspected to see what you're bringing into the country. And so Israel said, we're going to put up a blockade. No, we're going to break through that blockade. We want to show that we can come into the Gaza Strip anyway. Israel said, no, we're not going to. So they put commandos on the ship. As soon as the commandos landed, they were violently attacked by the people on the ship. And they killed a number of people on that ship and stopped it from coming into Israel. Well, then we're there, and the next day they said the tensions are too high. Ship can't dock in Israel, the cruise ship, so we never got to go to Jerusalem. It's going to happen again in a couple more days, another blockade. Why? Trying to deny Israel the right to protect itself from basically invasion or shipment of prohibited weapons. But what will happen is the press will magnify the what they call civilian casualties, because they'll say Israel is wrongly attacking this ship that's coming into Gaza and shouldn't do that. Without reporting again and again when Israel tries to defend itself, they don't report that weapons were hidden in schools or homes or mosques, or missile launchers that were launching missiles against Israel were hidden in mosques or schools. They say, oh, Israel's killing civilians. Well, without recognizing the context in which those killings occur. Or, you remember the accusations that U.S. soldiers caused destruction to museums in Iraq, and the treasures of Iraq were being destroyed, and they weren't being protected by Americans? This was kind of all over the press, really an anti-American bias in that press emphasis. What actually happened was a Wall Street Journal editorial, November 14 to 15, 2009, said, in 2008, finally, a trip by top Western archaeologists to southern Iraq's 8 most important sites found little or no post-Saddam damage, much to the archaeologists' surprise. Oh, the Americans didn't loot after all. And there was an excellent article by Emilio Marrero. He was chaplain for the Marine Expeditionary Force that secured Babylon from looters. He said they worked conscientiously to protect the site. They ejected looters. They made repairs to the perimeter. They established ground rules. And they said after Saddam's forces evacuated, the museum was in poor condition, but they protected it, and Americans didn't loot it at all and didn't allow looting to go on. Now, as for the National Museum in Iraq, it's back again open to the public. The majority of its greatest treasures are back on display. And the museum's most valuable items were all the time locked away in a vault, untouched by looters. But my question is, how much of that vindication of American troops has been reported in the mainstream media? Essentially nothing. There was widespread criticism of American troops, wrongful criticism, but now when the truth comes out, the media yawns, goes on its way, issuing other reports that malign the American military and undermine pride in our country. Number 6, global warming. Widespread scientific disagreement on global warming, but the mainstream media simply reports on global warming as a proven fact. Number 7, media bias in favor of Barack Obama. As I said, 70% of the American population thought the media wanted Obama to be elected. Virtually no coverage of the man that started Barack Obama on his political career, Bill Ayers, an unrepentant terrorist bomber. And I'll skip over point B, but there's some more there. Point C, what about President Obama's earlier connection to the organization ACORN, Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now? He had worked for them as a community organizer. He had represented and defended them as a lawyer. What's the problem with ACORN? Michigan, Secretary of State said ACORN had submitted a sizable number of duplicate and fraudulent applications to register people to vote. Nevada, Secretary of State Ross Miller said there were false names and fictional addresses submitted as voters, including the starting lineup of the Dallas Cowboys being submitted as legitimate voters. Nevada's Clark County Registrar of Voters, Larry Lomax, said rampant fraud in 2,000 to 3,000 applications per week submitted to register voters by ACORN. Ohio, investigating voter fraud connected with ACORN. Florida, Seminole County, withholding acorn registrations that appear fraudulent. New Mexico, North Carolina, Missouri, looking into hundreds of dubious acorn registrations. Wisconsin, investigating acorn employees for making up people or registering people that were still in prison. Lake County, Indiana, found more than 2,100 bogus voter registrations applications among the 5,000 acorn dumped right before the deadline. All the signatures looked exactly the same. Bridgeport, Connecticut, about 20% of Acorn's registrations were faulty. Houston rejected or put on hold about 40% of the 27,000 registration cards submitted by Acorn, and that's just in 1 year. Now, it seems to me this shows a consistent intentional organizational pattern to commit election fraud and rig election results with thousands of votes from dead or non-existent people all over the country. Here's the question. Why was President Obama so closely tied to an organization such as Acorn in the past? The mainstream media just yawns and lets it pass. Why? That's the question. Maybe the connection is innocent. Maybe there was no wrongdoing or endorsement of this voter fraud procedure, but it doesn't seem to me that it was investigated. And when was this? President Obama served as a lawyer for Acorn in 1995. He led voter registration efforts in 1992. Compare that to the media attention given to supposed wrongdoing by George W. Bush in 1972 and 73, as opposed to President Obama's connection with Acorn in 1992 to 95. That's much more recent, much more relevant to perhaps his current policies, but almost no media attention. And then the question of economic statistics. And see how I'm doing on time. I think I'm still okay. Okay, well, I'll press on a little bit here. Unemployment at the time of Obama's election was 6.7%. For much of President Bush's term, unemployment hovered around 4 to 4.5%, which is a healthy economy. It started to grow up because of the economic downturn in 2008. Unemployment started to go up. So here it is, about 4.3 in 2007. And it starts to take a big upturn in 2008, climbs to 5%, 6%, and when President Obama was elected, unemployment was 6.7%. Here, okay. Then President Obama and his administration proposed this stimulus plan, which was government spending $814 billion. That's about $2,400 per taxpayer that it was going to spend. $4,800 per taxpayer. Something large for each of you. And this was going to solve the problem. And the predictions were, if you don't pass this stimulus, this recovery plan, the unemployment rate will go up to 9%, and it'll be a long time, and it won't decline significantly until 2011 or 2012, which is down here. But if you pass the stimulus plan, within a few months, unemployment is going to decline. It'll go down to 7%. It'll go down to 6%. And it should be, by this time, 6.2%. But what happened after the stimulus plan was passed, unemployment shot up, and it stayed up way above 9%, hitting 10% at some places. And this chart is now a year old, but unemployment still is here, about 9%, way in excess of the projections of if you just vote for this stimulus plan of $814 billion. Now, here's my question. Point G on your outline, it should say lack of success of the costly stimulus plan that was passed with no Republican votes. And there the chart shows this. The actual unemployment data has stayed high. Now, we are still in a situation of about 9% unemployment. And when you add in discouraged job seekers who've given up looking for a job and aren't counted in the statistics, it may be 20% unemployment. And I'll tell you, I know people in this class who have been affected by the economic downturn. In fact, it's hard for me to think of anybody I know who has not been affected by the economic downturn. It's been a very, very difficult situation. My question is this: with so many people unable to find work, why have the mainstream media not loudly emphasized this huge national problem day after day? Why have they not laid any blame directly at the feet of President Obama's failed stimulus plan that was supposed to create so many new jobs? And pointed out that it was passed with no Republican votes in the House, only 3 liberal Republican votes in the Senate. The unemployment rate remains high. Why? Because business owners saw the huge increase in government spending. They realized it had to be paid somehow by more taxes that would fall on them. They saw the likely passage of Obama's health care proposal and knew it would require additional massive increases in their required health insurance costs, so they decided not to hire but to cut back their workforce. Why has there been no ongoing media outrage, no ongoing focus on this prolonged national tragedy of high unemployment? Why have the failed tax and spend policies of the present administration been given a pass by the mainstream national media? That's my question. I had other areas that I could talk about. I went with Margaret to the grocery store yesterday, and she said, "Wayne, the prices of everything are going up. It cost me much more to buy groceries than it did a few months ago." Well, I don't know if you were in this class a year ago when I said that economic stimulus plan is also now, we've got the Federal Reserve Board dumping cash into the economy, and it is going to result in inflation, and there's more coming. But why is that not being highlighted by the media? That this inflation that we're experiencing at the gas pump and in the grocery store is the result of government policies of taxing and spending and putting more money into the economy. Or another one, border security problems, underreported. Headlines saying unemployment is getting better. And, oh, gas prices are coming down, without saying they were $1.79 when Obama was elected, and they're over $4 now per gallon. And without tying the increase in gas prices to President Obama and the Democrats' opposition to oil drilling and 15 years of defeating plans to start drilling in ANWR, the Alaska National Wildlife Reserve, which would have put much more oil into our economy and brought down the price of gas. Or why so little, if any, reporting of the great damage that comes from homosexual conduct between human beings and the health problems that come. Again and again, it seems to me we have a problem of media bias or underreporting or wrongful reporting. My conclusion is this: there is a harm to a nation that comes when the press fails to fulfill its role of being the guardians of accountability for the government. What happens if the government does wrong and the press is silent? What happens if the press just gives a certain viewpoint or a certain party or a certain politician a pass on anything that is done? It's like having a country protected by watchdogs that cannot bark. And the Hebrew prophet Isaiah knew this had happened with the nation of Israel long ago. He said, "His watchmen are blind, they are all without knowledge, they are all like silent dogs, they cannot bark, dreaming, lying down, loving to slumber." When this happens, when the watchdogs cannot bark, they fail to call leaders to account, the people of a nation do not have adequate information to make wise decisions about their leaders. When the watchdogs are silent, a nation will soon be led astray by its leaders, who no longer have sufficient accountability to the public. Okay, I've got about 10 minutes that you can interact with me. And look, I know that was much more partisan than I've been in the past in terms of parties. And if you want to push back on that, you're certainly welcome to. Pammy?
Wayne, I get the feeling that it just can't be by coincidence or by people that are of a different viewpoint of themselves personally, I get the feeling this has got to be a demonic thing, because it's like, I just don't think it's so well orchestrated. I just don't think it's humanly possible. And I really believe that we do wage battle against, not against flesh and blood, but against powers that have darkness. And I just, but I don't know. You tell me what you think on that.
I don't know either. Yeah, Kathy.
Just a couple of thoughts. My experience is that reporters are basically lazy. And so they come in and they want, they've got their particular viewpoint and they don't do their homework. I mean, that's what we experience on a state level, is that they're just lazy. So they've got their bias, their viewpoint. They really don't want to know the facts. I mean, that's what we see repeatedly. The other thing, when you look for alternative news sources, I just have a pet peeve that I have to share. If you go to blogs to get news sources, be very careful about anonymous blog posts. And that's what, you know, when we look for alternatives, when we see the liberal media bias, so we look to alternative sources. Mm-hmm. A lot of us go to blogs to get our news now, but just be careful that you're not, believing an anonymous blog post can be just as bad as a liberal media bias.
Conservative blog post,
yes.
You're saying. Yeah.
Yes. You may be on a conservative blog and you may think it's great, but just be very careful, because if they're anonymous, they can be just as off as the most liberal media bias we've got.
Kathy, have you been wrongly reported about? I mean, what's your feeling, or what's your experience in the past?
Well, one example that we had, my mind kind of goes blank. Yeah, we get plenty of false reporting. But one thing that happened this spring, we had a bill that would become law, actually on July 20th, to establish a preference in adoption for a married man and woman. And so the Channel 5 reporter who was doing this story came to my house to do the interview. What she wanted to do was the angle that she wanted to do more than anything else was the young woman who had a child in foster care, was a foster parent, and who, oh my gosh, this bill might not let her adopt this child. That's not what the bill would have done. That's not what the law will do. But she wanted to do that viewpoint. So she really wasn't interested in the facts about what the law would do. And it would just say that all other factors being equal, that the child, if you've got a choice between the child going to a single individual versus to a married couple, the married couple would have a preference. But if that child already had a relationship with a foster parent, had a relationship with a relative who wanted to adopt the child, that the married preference wouldn't apply.
Yeah, yeah.
But that reporter wasn't interested in the facts. And I think that's where part of it was laziness, and part of it was the emotional tug of the story was to see this woman playing with a child, playing ball with a child, and, oh, my gosh, it would disrupt this relationship.
So now she's got a story she wants to push.
Yeah, the emotional tug of the story is far more important than whatever the facts would be on a lot of the issues that I deal with.
Ken? Yeah, and then back here.
Can you comment, do you think there'll be any traction? We hear about it from time to time on the fairness doctrine in the media.
Yeah. I think that more liberal Democrats have wanted to push a fairness doctrine, which is saying that every talk radio outlet has to, if they give an hour to Rush Limbaugh or Hugh Hewitt or a conservative reporter or commentator, then they have to give the next hour to a liberal, it would destroy the listenership and the revenue for conservative talk radio, and that's the push for it. I don't think so. I think the Supreme Court ultimately will find that an abridgment of freedom of the press. But we have to watch out for it, that it not be pushed on us by the Federal Communications Commission, for instance. Yeah. Okay, next to Bob. What's your name?
Can you give some reasons why or some thoughts on why the media attracts liberal journalists, or why journalists are attracted to the media? That kind of relationship there, why it seems to be an attraction of sorts in that way.
What's your name?
Ryan.
Ryan, yeah. That's a great question, and I don't know the answer. I have a son, Elliot, our oldest son, who 2 years in a row was an excellent editor for his high school newspaper at a big high school in Libertyville, Illinois. And he was thinking of going to journalism, but the pay is so low and the job openings for anything were so limited that he kind of turned aside to that, ultimately went into the business world, worked for Geico Insurance, and then he became a pastor so he could get high pay. Just kidding. So I don't know. I mean, he had a little acquaintance with journalistic profession. Sarah Palin majored in journalism, interestingly enough, I think that's true. And there are some conservative people in the journalistic world, but the dominant culture is more liberal. And partly it's that people who go into journalism see it as they have an agenda. They want to change the world and change the world in the direction of the political viewpoints that they hold. So World Magazine has a journalism institute that trains journalists. And it has a more conservative, I think more Bible-based worldview. But that's small compared to the big journalism schools. Yep. What's your name?
Brent.
I
just wanted to say about what that woman was talking about whether it's spiritual or something, why people in the media, you know, support one view or not.
Yep.
I think of like my dad, he's more falls on the Democratic side and more liberal and
yep.
and stuff like that when it comes to abortion or homosexuality or things like that. But so I can show him things when I was a teenager, when I first started getting to paying attention more when I became a Christian.
Yep.
Stuff didn't sound true to me. I was like, well, maybe I shouldn't support some of these Clinton policies or
yep.
whatever, you know. And it's similar. But I can show him things. No matter what I show him, he's not going to agree, you know, because mm-hmm. Or he might say, well, yeah, well, Bush did the same thing or something.
Yep.
You know, he just
yep.
can't. So I think that but I also think that if you're a Christian and you get into politics or looking at the worldview of anything, you have a bias too. You know, I think you want your guy to be right too. So when people say bad things about them that you shouldn't agree with as a Christian,
yep.
you kind of want to, well, you know, maybe he
yep.
didn't mean it or something. You know what I mean? I think there is
yep.
some spiritual element to this. So
yep.
that's all.
I appreciate what you say. We shouldn't just say, oh, they have bias without realizing that we want to see certain things reported too. I suppose the response is, well, let's try to be even-handed in terms of emphasizing wrongdoing equally, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, investigating wrongdoing equally, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, and definitely being very upfront and front page to admit wrong when something has been slanderous against someone else so that reputations can be cleared. It's that kind of thing. I would hope that happens. I would hope there's more fair reporting on the more conservative side. We have to talk about specific examples then too. But that's something to be aware of. Okay, now I'm going to have to remember your name again. Cleona?
Cleora.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask your opinion on something. It seems like there is so much corruption in the voting system in this entire country.
Yep.
One wonders if the good guys can really win. And what can we do as ordinary citizens to help stop the corruption?
Well, there's pushback coming, Cleora. That is, there are voter registration laws that require photo ID, passed in a number of states now, or being passed and considered in a number of states. I think that would help a lot. Margaret and I have taken to doing this vote by mail thing. And so it's easy. So we do it. But it always makes me suspicious of who's getting all these ballots and are they going to just, you know, people getting hundreds of them and just mailing. I don't know. But it's still possible to win elections. Okay. Yeah.
I have a question and a thought. First of all, has the media always been liberal biased, or did it change sometime in the past?
It changed sometime in the past.
So it used to be another way. But it seems like as we progress, due to political correctness, spinning
okay.
and misleading and so forth is almost to the point of lying outright.
Okay. I remember sitting in the faculty lounge at Trinity Divinity School sometime in the 1980s in a conversation with Carl F. H. Henry, who was just this very eminent theologian but had a journalistic background, and saying to him one time, boy, this article in the newspaper, I don't know, Chicago Tribune or New York Times, I said, this doesn't seem very fair. It seems biased. And he said, the media is all agenda journalism now. There isn't any attempt to just present the facts impartially and fairly. That shocked me. That was in the 80s. So something had happened in the 60s, 70s, 80s. I think what happened was our society lost a sense of respect for truth and a sense of moral obligation before God to speak the truth in whatever you speak. And when that left, then why do you go into journalism? To promote a cause, to promote an idea. And what keeps you honest? Well, you lose circulation if it's proved too often that you're like a National Enquirer or something like that and just make up stuff. So that's the restraining influence, but it's not nearly as strong as I have accountability before God to tell the truth. He's watching me. So I think that a diminishing of the role of respect for truth in society has been a major factor.
And the second part of that, I think, is with a diminishing morality, in the country, and the dumbing down of America, if you will, due to misleading things. Are people discerning anymore to even know that this is a spin of the truth and not the truth?
Yep, a lot of people know that. That's why, what do you get, these 23% think that news media will correct their errors or that, you know, that they're trustworthy and things like that. So there's a distrust because people, by God's grace, have in their hearts a sense of, let's have the truth, honestly. There's still that because of people's conscience. So that's a restraining influence. Last comment, Joyce.
I'm thinking of Ryan's question over here about why, you know, what's the connection with reporters in that point of view.
Yep.
When I first began to become interested in the political things was, you know, when I'm in my early 20s, and I began to watch and read and so forth. And I, in my opinion, well, and of course I was a Democrat. I became a Democrat because it appealed to my emotions and my sympathy.
Yep.
And I think that a lot of journalists find it a lot easier, for instance, in Kathy, what Kathy was talking about, the journalists could be a lot more successful in appealing to people's emotions than telling the truth of the matter. Mm. And we're suckers. We tend to respond to that emotion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the old saying, when you're young, if you're not a Democrat, you have no heart. If you're old and you're not a Republican, you have no brains. There is a little truth to that. There really
is. I'm not going to make any comment. There are a lot of things said. A lot of things said today. The comments that I'm not going to comment on one way or the other. I'll just let them stand as interesting comments from various members of the class. Okay, Graham. Our Father, we thank you that you are the ruler, the sovereign God who rules over nations and over the destinies of nations. We are concerned, Father, about the tendency of the powerful media to impact our nation in a way that seems so contrary to your moral standards on a number of issues. And so we ask for a solution. We don't even have enough wisdom to know what the solution would be. But we ask for a renewed commitment to truth and fairness and objectivity in reporting, and a conviction of the need to promote what is true and fair and right on the part of the dominant media in our country. And in fact, that they would again value and want to promote what is good for the nation and good for the people of the nation and good in your sight. Help us, our Lord. We need your help. Amen. See you next week.